The economy and the markets continue to improve.
But not everyone is cashing in.
From APM American Public Media, I'm Adrian Hill in Los Angeles.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. You're listening to the Marketplace Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It is Wednesday, February 29th, Leap Day.
Coming up, how super PACs are extending the primary election season.
And James Murdoch steps down as executive chair of News International.
Plus, what the new Google privacy policy you probably won't read means for you.
Those stories and more just ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Don't miss the numbers, the news, and Kai's final note. Subscribe to the Marketplace podcast. Find it on iTunes or online at marketplace.org/podcasts.
We learned this morning that the nation's economy grew at a rate of 3% at the end of 2011. The gross domestic product is a touch higher than initial estimates of 2.8% from the Department of Commerce.
And it's one more piece of good news economic data. For more, we go to Kash Mansouri. He's an economic consultant who runs the blog The Streetlight, and he's been scouring the new GDP report for us. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm well. So what do you make of today's new GDP estimate?
Oh, I think it's a pretty nice report. It's more evidence that this narrative that has been building, that the U.S. economy may be entering a new phase of the recovery that's stronger and hopefully more sustainable, is heading in the right direction. So I like this report.
Any surprises in there for you?
I wouldn't say there were any surprises, but there's some nice little bits and pieces that you can find in there. What I've been particularly paying attention to is personal consumption expenditure. Since consumers drive 70% of spending in the U.S. economy, that's the number that I've been looking for sustainable growth. And it was revised upward a little bit and is growing now at a faster rate than we've seen in a couple of years.
Kash Mansouri is an economic consultant and runs the blog The Streetlight. Thanks so much.
You're very welcome. Have a good day.
Well, the positive GDP numbers have pushed markets higher this morning. At this hour, the Dow is above 13,000. It closed above 13,000 yesterday for the first time since 2008.
And it's a milestone you might guess would make investors happy, but not everyone's making money. Jill Schlesinger is editor-at-large for CBS Money Watch and joins us now. Good morning, Jill.
Good morning.
So how much have regular investors benefited from this market run-up?
I think a lot of ordinary investors haven't actually participated to the full extent. If we look at the last 5 years, we see that investors pulled almost $500 billion from the U.S. stock market. So that means when people were freaking out at the bottom, they were pulling money out of the stock market, and they probably didn't actually participate in a big part of this recovery.
So they haven't gotten the benefits that maybe investors that were less skittish did.
Absolutely. And you might even say this, that there's sort of an old saying on Wall Street that when you try to time the market, you don't have to make one great decision. You got to make two great decisions. One, getting out at the right time, and two, when to get back in at the right time.
And so how do regular investors avoid making the same mistake in the future?
You know, I still think that the tried and true diversified portfolio really does protect you. And it's not so much about your performance on the way up, but it is about not getting spooked on the way down. If the market was down 50% and your portfolio was only down 20%, now 20% is a big number, but it's not quite as scary as that 50. And I think more people are willing to stay with that portfolio if there isn't as much risk. I think the big lesson that we've seen is a diversified portfolio actually serves people well on the bottom, and it serves them well on the way back up.
Jill Schlesinger from CBS Money Watch, thanks.
Great to be with you.
Now to another breaking story today. James Murdoch, the son of Rupert Murdoch, has resigned as chairman of News International. That's a division of News Corporation, which owns Fox News, The Wall Street Journal, and many other media outlets around the world. Marketplace's Stephen Beard joins us from London with the latest details on this. Good morning, Stephen.
Hello, Jeremy.
So tell us why this sudden resignation, and does it change the succession plan at News Corporation?
No. I mean, analysts here are saying that it's designed to ensure that James does eventually succeed his father, Rupert, as head of News Corp. Let's be clear. James has resigned from the chairmanship of the British newspaper arm of News Corp, which owns titles like The Sun, The Sunday Times, and The Times. The company says it's so that James can concentrate on the firm's international TV businesses. And one can certainly understand why he would want to do that. The British newspapers are in serious trouble because of that phone hacking scandal.
So he stays on at the company, but that scandal that you mentioned, it's not going away.
No, it certainly isn't. I mean, just to remind you, it emerged last year. Some Murdoch papers, particularly the News of the World, had routinely hacked into the cell phones of not just celebrities, but some ordinary, vulnerable people caught up in the news. That led to the setting up of a big public inquiry, and there have been some extraordinary revelations coming out of that. Most recently, the claim that one of the Murdoch papers may have conspired to obstruct a murder investigation because it involves some of the private eyes it was using in its news gathering. So there's every reason why James, as the heir apparent of Rupert, would want to distance himself from these papers.
We'll keep watching. Marketplace's Stephen Beard in London. Thanks a lot.
Okay, Jeremy.
And now from one privacy story to another. But this next intrusion is legal. Tomorrow, Google's new privacy policy goes into effect. And I don't blame you if you haven't read it yet. I haven't. But it will mean that when we search the web or check our Gmail account, it's going to be a whole lot easier for Google to keep track of us. Sabri Benashour explains.
Actually, I'll let Chris Gaither explain it. He's a spokesperson for Google.
Let's say that you do a lot of searches on Google for recipes. Next time you go to YouTube while you're signed into the same Google account, you might see some recommendations to subscribe to a YouTube cooking channel, for example.
By combining the data it picks up on its various sites into one profile, it'll be easier for Google to target ads to you. David Jacobs is with the Electronic Privacy Information Center.
The overarching problem is the loss of control for users. You can't really opt out.
But do users know this? Have they even read the policy?
People didn't read these privacy policies before, and they're not likely to read them now.
Ryan Kahlo is privacy director at the Stanford Center for Internet and Society. But some people do read them. More than 30 attorneys general have sent Google a letter complaining about the policy. I'm Sabri Benashour for Marketplace.
Now to the global perspective on business and economics. We got some better-than-expected economic data from Japan today, but the country's economy is still recovering from the earthquake and tsunami that hit last March.
For the first time since the disaster, foreign journalists have been allowed inside the Fukushima nuclear power station. The BBC's Roland Burke just toured the plant and joins us from Tokyo. Good morning.
Good morning.
You were one of the few journalists let inside the Fukushima plant. What was it like?
Well, we had to get dressed up in protective gear, white plastic boiler suits, respirators, triple layers of gloves, plastic overshoes as well, to go in there and face the radiation. We were taken right up to the reactors. What we saw was that the reactors are now stabilized, they're being cooled, but the way it's being done still looks pretty makeshift, to be honest. There are plastic pipes of water running all over the site. That's a circulation system. And the plant's manager says he would like it to be a more secure system. And what they're worried about there is another tsunami, another earthquake. That could tip what is a pretty stable disaster now back into crisis again.
And what have we learned about how the U.S. worked with Japan during the crisis?
Well, when you go around the Fukushima nuclear plant, you can see messages from the US, from nuclear regulators and authorities in the United States, handwritten messages of good luck in the control room. What they say is that they needed the help and they were grateful for the help of other nations in tackling the crisis. And they are also going to be seeking advice and want help of other nations in the next phase. And that's going to be to try to dismantle the plant, to try to decontaminate the area around it. It's a huge job, and the Japanese government warns it could take up to 40 years.
The BBC's Roland Burke in Tokyo. Thanks.
Thank you.
Now to the Republican primary. Mitt Romney is headed to Ohio today after wrapping up those two primary victories in Arizona and Michigan last night. Rick Santorum heads to Tennessee, but we are going to focus on Michigan for a moment because Michigan has been in the spotlight for weeks now, the national spotlight, and it's starting to get back to business as usual this morning. So what did we learn from all that coverage and what did we miss? Zoe Clark is a reporter with Michigan Radio. She's with us now from Ann Arbor. Good morning.
Good morning, Jeremy.
Well, there was a lot of talk about the auto bailout in the campaign. How big of an issue was that for voters yesterday in Michigan?
Jeremy, I think it was an issue, but what we have to remember here in the state is that 62% of Republicans, Michigan Republicans, actually opposed the bailout. Hmm. So, of course, it's going to be on people's minds, but this was pretty much a majority of Republicans voting yesterday. I think it's going to be a much bigger deal come November.
And now, last night, I was watching your governor, Rick Snyder, and he was saying something that he's been saying over and over again the last couple of weeks, which is that Michigan is the great comeback state right now. How do you think the nation's perceptions of Michigan have changed over the last couple of weeks?
Well, I think that's the narrative that's coming out of the state. And truthfully, we are starting to see an economic turnaround here in the state. We went from the nation's highest unemployment rate. We are no longer the nation's top. Still up there, though. So it is true that things tend to be getting better.
What do you think was missed in the national coverage of Michigan about its economy?
Foreclosures and home prices. You know, we heard so much about the bailout, a lot about Detroit. What we didn't hear about is the fact that there are still a ton of people in Michigan who owe more on their homes than they're worth. And what we didn't hear a lot from the national campaigns, you know, from Romney and from Santorum, was how they're going to fix that. And I think that's going to be a really, really important issue among Michigan voters come November.
Zoe Clark of Michigan Radio, thanks so much.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Turns out the extended nature of this year's Republican campaign may be related, at least in part, to the rise of the super PAC, funded by unlimited donations. Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports.
In the primary so far, over 300 state GOP delegates have been selected. Yet even candidates with little chance of reaching the magic number for nomination are still in the fray.
It used to be that candidates for president would drop out after they lose a few primaries. Now they don't drop out until they lose the millionaires who are paying for the ads on those super PACs.
Larry Makinson has been tracking money in politics for 25 years.
It's not the voters who are deciding who stays in or who gets out. It's those people who are sending in those very big checks.
Checks that pay for a lot of negative ads, which Makinson says undermine voter trust in all the candidates. Professor Bruce Oppenheimer at Vanderbilt University says the longer super PACs drag out the Republican electoral battle, the tougher it'll be on the winner of the primaries.
That person is going to be a bit more beaten up politically.
Oppenheimer figures voter disgust with super PAC-sponsored ads is also contributing to declining turnout in recent primaries. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
And one more election story this morning, this one in Virginia, Adrian, where two former governors are running for Jim Webb's U.S. Senate seat. And so is a cat named Hank.
A cat.
Yes. This cat previously ran for state Senate and got 9 write-in votes. I don't know, from other cats or people or what. Well, anyway, Hank the Cat's website says he wants to bring milk to every bowl across this great nation. That's his campaign slogan. And he's quoted as saying, if I had to sum up my feelings for Virginia's future, I would have to say,
meow. Nice.
There you go.
What else can you say if you're a cat?
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
What does middle class mean? That's today's question as we launch our new Wealth and Poverty Desk.
The American dream is shaking right now.
Top 1%.
I think we're very blessed to have what we have.
The 99%.
I've never been one to look for a handout.
It used to be that being middle class meant you were realizing the American dream. But as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports, it's more complicated now.
A lot of Americans think of themselves as middle class. My family does. We arrived more than a century ago in Philadelphia with the proverbial clothes on our backs, delivered bread, and sewed men's suits. A couple generations later, we were teachers, accountants, and cardiologists. I dialed up my first cousin, Marcy Tanter. She teaches English at a state college near Fort Worth, Texas. Are you middle class?
Yes, and I think for the most part our family is. Pretty much everybody's got a college education. Everybody has jobs. We travel. We have computers and iPads and iPods and cars.
We're lucky to be in the upper middle class sweet spot with incomes in the top 25%. We'll be able to help our kids with SAT classes, college costs, or a first home. Some of our relatives haven't made out as well. They didn't go to college and have worked in real estate, construction, waitressing, selling auto parts. In the Great Recession, a few have lost homes or gone bankrupt. Welcome to America's struggling middle, says University of Wisconsin economist Timothy Smeeding. It's people making around the median income, $50,000 a year.
And this group is still middle class, but 10 years ago, they were behind the white picket fence, and they had a nice house and steady jobs, and their kids would do better than they would. And now they're finding a lot of that crumbling.
Smeeding says with the increased computerization of manufacturing and secretarial work, people with less education have limited long-term prospects.
What's left to them are personal services. Cashiers, sales clerks, lawns, food preparation, those jobs don't pay a lot of money. So the traditional avenues to the middle class are gone. At the same time, people with higher education, particularly postgraduate degrees, are doing really well.
So what's the middle class? Well, there isn't just one. There are two, and they're pulling apart. Get higher education or technical training, chances are you'll do pretty well. Miss out on post-high school education, end up working jobs that require few advanced skills, and you could find your family squeezed out of the middle class altogether. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
It's February 29th. Happy Leap Day. Especially happy if you're a business. Turns out the extra day can be a nice little bonus for the economy. From WMFE in Central Florida, Mark Simpson reports.
Central Florida just pulled off a banner weekend. The NBA All-Star Game played in downtown Orlando, and the Daytona 500 crowd stuck around after the race was extended by one day because of rain. Now comes an extra day for businesses, Leap Day. Mega marketer Walt Disney announced it's keeping Disneyland and Disney World open 24 hours today, and that got the attention of area businesses.
Disney, of course, led the way by being open 24 hours for Leap Year Day.
That's Jennifer Rice Palmer, who's the general manager at the Lake Buena Vista Clarion Inn. The hotel is located almost next door to Disney properties, so following Disney's lead makes sense.
And we said, okay, if you come and you stay with us and you're staying more than one night and staying over the 29th, we'll pay for that night. It'll be completely free here at the hotel.
Economist Hank Fishkind says even though hotels might offer a free night stay, they can still end up coming out ahead.
And the reason that happens is because there's food and beverage monies that people spend and merchandise, and so those things are significant to a hotel's profit.
Fishkind points out that for big companies, that can mean big bucks.
There's about 200 work days in a normal work year, and now we have an extra one. So there'll be a little more production, people have a little more income than they otherwise would, and they'll spend a little more. So there are broad economic effects. Now, they're small. 1/200th increase, but nevertheless significant.
At Clarion Inn, Jennifer Rice Palmer says she's using Facebook to get the promotion out.
We're doing it unique for all of our friends who are liking us on Facebook, and so you have to qualify for it by coming and liking us on Facebook. But then as soon as you do that, you're open to this unique opportunity.
She also reports that Facebook interest has increased and the Leap Day special seems to be improving what is usually a midweek slump for bookings. In Orlando, I'm Mark Simpson for Marketplace.
So, it is Leap Day, as we just heard, Adrian, and it may be a good thing if you own a business, but it can be tough if it is your birthday.
In today's Midday Extra, we go to Raynell Dawn. She's the co-founder of the Honor Society of Leap Year Day Babies. Good morning and happy birthday.
Good morning, thank you, and happy Leap Day to you.
So, what sort of issues do Leap Year babies come across?
Well, Leap Day babies have the very first issue of the birth certificate where the doctors will suggest to the parent to put February 28th or March 1st instead of having to deal with that February 29 date. And then when we grow up, those of us that do have February 29 on our birth certificates, when we get our driver's license, it can be a hassle because the computer system won't have our birth date in the system. So the driver's license will have February 29 as our birth date, but the expiration date will have to be a different one, February 28 or March 1st. And there's a lot of agencies, government agencies that will do that because the computer systems don't recognize February 29 as a date in the off years.
Well, Raynell, now you're turning 13 today officially, right?
I am.
Which means that if you were born on February 28th, you would be turning what right now?
I would be 52.
52. Okay. So you're saying that even though one in, I think, 1,461 people are born on Leap Days. I saw it this morning. One in that many people are born on Leap Days, that the government has not figured out how to make their computer systems work for you guys?
Yeah, and it's a hassle. And it's not just them. It's computer websites, different software. They don't account for the February 29 date. So when we go to sign up on a website or register for something that requires our birth date,
you can't put it in.
No, it says invalid date. We put our birth date in, and it comes back. This window pops up and says, invalid date. Please try again. And so we have to, you know, sign up for things with an incorrect date. We might as well put June 3rd, you know?
But so it sounds a little frustrating, but there've got to be some upsides to having a leap day birthday too, right? I mean, you can brag to all your friends.
You know, when I was little, I got teased for not having a birthday and all that stuff, but the older we get, the more fun it is. It was really fun being 10 at 40. You do. You know, I'm digging it highly. It's pretty fun. You know, it's a pretty unique kind of a thing. And plus, we weren't born on a day that's in competition with anything. Leap day represents balance between the calendar and the seasons. And what a beautiful thing.
So if you were having a baby and the baby was due on February 28th or March 1st, and there was a leap day in between, would you hope that the baby was born on leap day or not?
I would, indeed.
So even though you've had that trouble with your birthdays, you take it?
Oh, indeed. Yes. They're hassles. But, you know, we're right at that place in history, in the history of our technology, of having to deal with this. And so it would be really good if we dealt with it now, since it's already been 2,000 years plus that it's been happening. It's going to keep happening for some time yet, so the computer companies need to get a hold of that right now before it gets really out of hand.
Well, Raynell Dawn, whose 13th birthday it is today, co-founder of the Honor Society of Leap Year Day Babies, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Well, you know, thank you very much, too, and happy leap day. It's not just our birthday. It's everyone's extra day. Do something good with it.
And finally, Jeremy, spam.
Spam.
Spam. The canned meat product turns 75 this year,
wow,
and it's rolling out what the company calls its first ever spokes character, Sir Canalot. He's an armored, bearded cartoon knight that I guess encourages spam eating. But it seems to me the cartoon knight does have a predecessor who pushed spam as a breakfast treat. Remember Monty Python?
What you got then?
Well, there's egg and bacon, egg, sausage and bacon, egg and spam, egg, bacon and spam, egg, bacon, sausage and spam, spam, bacon, sausage and spam.
That just makes me hungry.
You know, it's funny, Adrian. If you go to Hawaii, spam is still like
it's
a big
huge
thing that everybody likes. And they do not like it if you make fun of their spam eating habits. So
I was looking on the spam website. Apparently, according to the company that makes spam, a can of spam is sold every 3.1 seconds.
Wow.
That's a lot of
amazing
spam.
All right. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Adrian Hill. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
This is APM, American Public Media.